So before we start with the episode, just so you know, I had to cut a lot of that video because the delay from us to Gunnar to Fuerteventura, there was quite a delay. So I had to cut a lot. I hope you can still enjoy that episode, and let's get into it.
Welcome to our podcast, Up on Foil, where we talk all about foiling. Today is the 20th episode, and we have a guest today out of Fuerteventura, Gunnar Binyas. He has been on my social for a while. Everywhere I go, people talk about Gunnar, Gunnar this, Gunnar that. I listen to podcasts about winging, foiling, whatever, and everywhere there's Gunnar. So thank you, Gunnar, for coming to our show as well, and maybe clarify a few things. What I've read about you, 2021 Wing Foil League champion, Spanish Wing Foil Race champion, worked for North in Indiana. A lot of things to know about you, but really hard to like get some bullet points, and maybe you can help us out later on. Sportsman, waterman through and through, living in Fuerteventura. Gunnar, thank you for coming on the show. Is there anything you want to add right away?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, I've been living on Fuerteventura ever since I started kitesurfing, like around 2000. So pretty much one of the old locals here, and I've always been involved in new sports as they come along fairly quickly. And so I managed, I think I got the name for myself basically with the foiling and everything else like that, being one of the first guys every time a new discipline came along. It's like, Gunnar somehow done it. So
you came into kitesurfing early on. We talked to Aaron Kitesurf a while back, and he said he was also one of the first one in the 2000s. You came from kiting, I heard in a podcast. What do you mean by that? Were you just like a little kid running around with your kite, or was that there's kite sports as well? That maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah, I started flying kites when I was like 10 years old. My cousin, who is from Germany, he basically introduced me to a stunt kite, and I got like immediately hooked. So I've been sort of like flying kites like a lot since I've been like 10 years old and building my own kites. So I've always considered myself more a kiter than a kite surfer, because I love all kite things, single line kites, two line stunt kites, power kites, man lifting, anything that involves building and flying a kite, sort of, I love. I'm not just only like kite surfing when it comes to that. I mean, I did kite bugging in like quite high level in the UK before kite surfing started, like kite buggy racing. So I've been racing a lot, hence I have a bit of a like racing gene in me. That's why like, I do quite well in most racing disciplines that I join. And yeah, that's sort of.
Can you maybe educate me a bit? All these different kites. I actually have no picture. And kite booking, I imagine a little car that is pulled by a kite. Or maybe can clarify a bit for me.
Yeah, so kite bugging essentially is a three-wheeled cart that is being pulled by a power kite. It works with any type of power kite. But if you go to the high level, like we were doing in racing, we had extremely high aspect ratio racing kite and very overpowered. Like 100 kilo buggy going about 100 kilometers an hour type racing.
Insane.
So it's that like what we do on the water now is like relatively safe compared to what we used to do kite buggy racing. Actually, almost everything we do on the water is safer than any of the kiting we used to do on land. Like jumping around with power kites, jumping high. These kites didn't have depower, so we're talking about basically like a paraglider and jumping off like small hills and or attaching ourselves to goal posts and getting a lot of dumb stuff in the early 90s.
Yeah, every time I hear about kites on land, I'm kind of scared. I want to jump into that. Did you ever have like a bad situation on land with a kite?
Many. Yeah, it's unavoidable, especially kite buggy racing. I've had a lot of crashes, like horrible crashes. All you need is something to come loose on the buggy, and then this thing is crashing at high speed. But I mean, we tried to make it as safe for ourselves as possible. Like for me, it was very weird getting into kite surfing, because as soon as the first kite surfing brand that I rode for was Whippica, if you guys know who they are, such a long time ago, it was the first brand that I made. Inflatable kites. It's the Leg on Your Brothers, who we got to thank for all the kitesurfing nowadays. And in the beginning, none of the kitesurfing brands back then, there was like Nash, Cabrina, and Whippica, none of them had any way of releasing the kite. There was no like safety these things. Whereas from buggy racing, we're like, yeah, we need a way to shoot this thing away in the, at the slightest like trouble we get into.
Yeah.
Those power kites with no depower, if something went wrong at anything over like 50 kilometers an hour, it was quite dangerous and deadly. But even with those safeties, all you needed to do is catch a line under a wheel and off you go. I've had a few like pretty gnarly crashes where I've ended up like half my body being completely bruised and blue, looking like something out of Star Trek. And yeah, but I was until I turned 30. No, there's nowhere to do it here on Fuerteventura. It actually would be amazing here if we were allowed to, because we've got like great sand dunes where it would be awesome. There's some really old like Peterlin kiteboarding like shots from like the buggy kites that we made like 20 years ago or something like that. Those are amazing in those dunes, but now it's a natural reserve, so we're not allowed to go in there with any vehicles. So I don't really get it. My buggy is rusting in my guard.
Because I was in Sotavento Beach a few times, and there were a couple of years there was a guy who rented out these sail buggies in the lagoon when it was empty, went there up and down. But I imagine that was super slow compared to what you did.
They could go pretty fast. But yeah, they're not as fast as the kite buggies.
But you don't do that anymore. And you're in Fuerteventura and Coralejo, right? Do you know Julia, Fuerte Julia? We had her on a couple of episodes ago, and she said it's how beautiful it is, but how full it is of people. And maybe you can tell us, how do you feel? Are there a lot more tourists coming, many more people on the water?
The thing that winging did, it allowed us to go to a lot of spots that we normally wouldn't have been at, like with kites or any other sports. The main spots that Julia is talking about are essentially that used to be purely windsurfing, and those windsurfers wouldn't accept anybody else. And what winging has allowed is for a lot more people to go in into those spots, which causes some friction. I personally don't believe it's as critical as Julia says it is. I've been doing it a little bit longer. I mean, like I said, I'm 47. I've been here more than half my life. I've gone through it all. Like when I first came here as a kiter, the windsurfers were on me. Like, you know, you can't do this. You can't do this. You can't be here. Your sport sucks. You know, don't do this. So my answer was then to learn windsurfing. One of the few kiters that learned windsurfing after I learned kitesurfing, to just know the sport and also to prove a point that I could do it. But I actually get along with most of the windsurfers here. With most of the sports that I do, because I was the first to foil here. I was the first to surf foil here. I was the first to wing foil here. You know, typically I try to put myself in the shoes of the other sports a bit more, because I've done the other sports. So it's easy for me to go, okay, why are the windsurfers not so happy with, for example, a wing foiler or a kiter, like cutting into their wave? Yeah, there's good explanations for it. The windsurfers here, they have to wait half an hour to catch a wave. So they're not so happy when a wing foiler just all of a sudden turns around on the wave they're in front and then pop in. Hold on, something's happening in my kitchen. Just a second. All right, I'm back. Teenagers.
No alarm. All good.
Yeah, just her fault.
Nothing on fire.
So for me, I understand. Like a windsurfer takes half an hour to catch a wave on the main spot here. So I tend to just then go, okay, you can have the wave if I'm honored or not. I can just turn around and get another one. A lot of the, like, say, younger generation don't quite understand that. They can't put themselves in that situation because they haven't done the sport. Whereas I try to get along with everyone. Yeah, to a point. There are, like I said, there can be friction if there's dangerous situations. I typically don't care so much about tourists being there. A tourist can be just as dangerous as a local. Sometimes the locals can be even more dangerous than the tourists, given certain situations. And with winging, a lot of the bad situations are pre-programmed because of the wings people are using. That's a whole other subject on windows and safety and certain brands, which I really don't like and agree with, that they keep making material the way they do. So, yep. That causes more problems on the water than, let's say, the people themselves, at least on the winging side.
Can you maybe clarify?
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So basically, the wings I use are monofilm wings. They're completely monofilm. Yeah. They're from a brand called Aqueous. once you ride something that is like a windsurfing sail, which gives you a full view of everything around you, you realize how dangerous most other wings on the water are, especially wings that have zero visibility. And we all know which brands those are. Yeah, don't have to mention that. And most accidents where there's collisions or people dropping into people's waves and then hitting other people with their boards and wings happen from one or two specific brands. Yeah, it's always the same. I didn't see you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
and it's,
this is more of an issue
for those
than,
using it. It's really, you don't see anything.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. All right. Then you have a lot of tourists coming and probably the group, the locals, they have a special little bond or a special connection. Everyone probably knows everyone, right? So are there any problems between people living there, maybe trying to get more jobs, teaching or getting room for their pupils? Or are you guys on the same level and talking to each other?
It's very cliquey here. You have the Spanish locals, you have the German locals, you have the Italian locals. It's a bit divided, but it's not like there's like a lot of friction between those groups. It's just that people tend to sort of like gather towards those. Like it's Germans are very like they like being the Germans, they like speaking the language, and same thing with the Italians, but everyone still is friends with everybody. There's very few issues amongst the locals. There's the usual odd, you know, after some, for example, a collision or something, or somebody's broken some material that for like a week, everyone, like those two people hate each other, but then, you know, it sorts itself out. This is like normal human beings, but we don't actually have like massive friction. I've never tried to be so much part of any of the cliques. I tend to typically keep to myself. I'm known as a fairly, I say, antisocial guy on the water, because when I go on the water, I don't talk, I don't yell, I just go on the water. I am concentrating on my thing because it's also my job. I'm most of the time I'm on the water, I'm actually not enjoying it. I'm testing stuff. I'm in and out of the water. It's work. Sometimes I'm out on gear that doesn't work the way I need it to, and then it takes a lot of concentration, and I don't look so happy when I'm on the water, and I tend to keep to myself. You know, on the beach it's a different.
Can
different
we touch
thing.
On that?
Maybe talk.
Sure. Yeah.
So how did you get into testing? How did you get into the positions in these companies? How does it work? Like, did they send the prototypes there? Did you give feedbacks? Or how does that happen?
It's a long story. I mean, the way I got into development was when I joined my second sponsor, which was Peter Lynn Kiteboarding. I got quite immediately involved in the testing side. One of my best friends was the kite designer there at the time. He's actually the kite designer for North now, Pine Smith. And just working with him, I learned a lot about the process of testing and development, got to know a lot how the industry works sort of on the back end, like how the products are developed and what else is involved. A lot of people don't know, like there's a lot of stuff that goes around in the background that has almost nothing to do with actual design and testing. There's material sourcing, trying to figure out how to actually build things. That's, for example, something like a kite bar is not as simple as people think it is to manufacture safely. So I got quite heavily into that, especially on the accessory side at Peter Lynn, trying to figure out, you know, how the bars would work. You know, back then we were the holy grail back then was to get bars that could be spun and the safety leash would spin with it and all that stuff. Everything we take for a given now. Back in 2005, 2006, now that's the thing we were trying to figure out and make work safely. So that was quite fun working in that. And I did the same thing for Fly Surfer when I joined them. And then when it came to foiling, I essentially started designing foils because there was no other option. When I started foiling, you had the Carafino foil, which was okay, I guess, but it was really badly made. So like the ones we had here broke like instantly. So we had to figure stuff out. And then also I wanted to travel with the thing, so I didn't want this big key foil, which where the fuselage is attached to the mast and everything. So back then with a friend of mine, Helmut from Magma, we came up with the first separatable thing, actual fuselage and mast is a separate part and so on. We started making foils here because what to do if you don't have anything at the time. So that's how I started developing foils. The first foils were all sort of hand shaped and everything. We didn't really know what we were doing. But then after 2011, 2012, I basically taught myself CAD and design and basically started designing foils properly and haven't really stopped since.
And what was your background before that? Because I guess that you need like some sort of knowledge in the like physics something, right?
No. I'm a computer engineer. I'm a computer engineer and accountant by background.
It's impressive. Yeah. That is impressive. But first, you must have had some things that you tried that didn't work at all. Or did it work from day one?
No. Like in the beginning, it was all trial and error. And a lot of standing on the beach, sanding and making things work. I did know quite a bit of how to make things fly from, I think I built my first own kite when I was like 12. So it's not like I started like completely from nothing with the kite flying, you know, something that flies and something that flies underwater. The rudimentary basics of design are still fairly similar, especially when it comes to geometry and so on. So it wasn't completely new. It still was a lot to learn, but even back then, there was a lot of resources, especially from the U.S. Navy. There's a lot of literature on hydrofoils from about the 60s to the 80s, where they did most of the testing and most of the math. So that was already fairly existing. But the hardest part was trying to figure out what works in air and then how it actually translates to water, where it doesn't go one-to-one. And then you also got to realize that foiling as a board sport, it's very feeling is more important than the actual like performance on paper. So
it's more testing than just thinking that that's gonna be the best, more performance foil. All right. And how long did it take to get a decent foil? Of course, like I can imagine it compared to what we've got now, it was kind of not really performant. But how long did it get to say, all right, I think I got it?
Fairly quickly. People hate me for saying this, but foils, if you look at purely at design, foils have not improved since 2016.
Yeah.
There hasn't actually been a massive leap in regards to profiles or outlines and shape. The racing foils that we basically designed in 2016, 2017, and so on are essentially as high performance as it gets. There's nothing better. High performance foils we have now are all based upon what Mike Sychek and Stefano Morris did back in 2016 with the Mike's Lab foils. We haven't actually done anything better. What we've done is we've managed to now get to a point in mass production where we can produce these foils at like a lower cost and make it. The biggest problem before was with the materials we had and the manufacturing capabilities we had in China and so on, was to make something that was that thin and that high aspect that wouldn't just immediately break. We are now at a level where we're like, we can make a mask like this and we can make a foil like this. These ultra high aspect foils are actually, for me, not something new. If you look way back through my Facebook things at pictures from like 2013, 2014, I'm on aspect ratio 11 and 12 prototypes. It's not like we weren't trying before. And the profiles we're using are actually not massively different. What we can do now is build them a lot better. And of course, like stiff, like the monoblock systems and how everything connects together nowadays, everything is a little more fine-tuned. But from a development standpoint on performance, I think the actual like hydrofoil speed record is actually still not beaten. It's still held by like the Spots 3 from like 2015, which I think some like 42 knots.
All right. All right. How were you producing these foils? Like, were you like the core mainly because of course, carbon fiber resin and whatnot. It's like wooden core, or were you using like specific materials? Wooden core, yeah.
It depends on how thick we made them. The first masks we made, which were about 19 millimeter thickness, we produced them with a foam core, like the high density foam, with like an I-beam in the middle. So you had like carbon and foam, and then you had the outside skins. But all the thinner ones, like, I think back in 2013, we made 1 meter long, 13 millimeter mask. That was just full carbon.
Can you tell us, maybe because you've been designing foils, and I heard somewhere, I'm not sure on which podcast it was, that you now 3D print your own molds. Can you tell us, if you have the idea of a new design, how long does that take? How many tries do you need to go through until I can buy it, for example?
So the best example now is just my current workflow, which I used to design the Barracuda for Indiana, was essentially I figured out even with the cheapest materials, I could 3D print the molds. I originally started experimenting with 3D printing the core and then laminating. It worked, but it wasn't the exact profile. I had to spend a lot of time sanding, using templates and so on, way too long. And then I figured out, okay, if I just 3D printed the actual full mold, yeah, it's going to use a lot of plastic, but I can probably get 2 or 3 foils out of it. And it's going to be fairly exact, which for me was more important at the time. And then printing the mold actually and preparing the mold is what takes the longest. So for example, for like a 800 square centimeter foil, the front wing mold would take about 2 days to print. And I've got a fairly large printer. It's got like 0.5 meter bed, so I can print at least half the wingspan easily. But once I have the mold, it takes me 24 hours and I have the foil. Yeah, it's just the curing time of the carbon.
And then you tell models, I have a new foil. You need to mass produce it. And another couple of months later, it's on the shop.
It's not that easy. I wish it was that easy. There's a lot of considerations. Like it's again what Mauro, sort of the boss, decides what we need and what we want to produce. Like last year, the high aspect foils weren't quite, let's say, in demand yet. So we decided to produce the Marlin first. So that's why the Barracuda came after the Marlin. So I mean, once we have a product that works, we need to convince the rest of the team. The main difference is, again, when I developed this on Fuerteventura, I did it alone and I wasn't testing with the rest of the other guys that are involved in the R&D team at Indiana. So those guys need to test it first. So eventually I managed to get the L size to Steve Fleury in Geneva. He tested it. He loved it. And then when I was in Zilvaplana for the racing, I let Balz Müller and so on test the M size. And then they were like super happy with it. And then Maurus then decided, yep, let's go. Let's do it.
Yeah, you need to, because you might like it, but you need some approval from the market before doing the investment of putting it into production.
But you give the input, or is Maurus going to say, we need that high aspect for example?
No. Like, at least in this respect with the Barracuda, it was, I built it and was like, we need it now. And then eventually they came around. Yeah. And the rest
what
of the industry also came around.
What are you most proud of?
I'm super proud about the Barracuda. Because it's something I was something I wanted to ride. And it turned out better than I expected it to. I wanted to build something that was just as high performing as the best race foils out there. But was like a mass produced product. So that was... I achieved that goal and made it even a bit better than I thought I would, yeah, especially on the pumping and the low end side. I've always been proud of the boards that I produced. We've always been a couple of years in advance of the rest of the industry. Like when we brought out the first wing foil boards in 2022, we were the first to actually have what shapes look like now. Like back then, if you remember all the other boards from the bigger brands, you had massive kicktails, double, triple concaves in the nose, no tail rocker, barely any scoop. Like super draggy boards that made it impossible to do the sport under 15 knots. And we essentially came around and went, oh, look, no, we have a nice slalom rocker line, scoop rocker line. No gimmicks at the bottom of the board that cause any drag. So I've always been quite proud that we were like the first to actually bring out proper wing boards like 3 or 4 years ago.
Talking foil, is the Condor XL also your piece of art?
No, that we have Jerome Badu to thank for.
He designed that?
Yeah, he came to us with that idea like 2 years ago, I think. Not quite 2 years ago, where he set the record for like an hour and a half on the 1396. And he was like, I have a better idea. I want something a bit more efficient, a little bit even higher aspect and so on. Not so geared towards beginners. So he came to us with the idea, and then him and Jan, who's our engineer, they perfected that. Because for me, pump foiling is super difficult on sort of a too windy most of the time, and we have nowhere to start easily.
Plus, you have wind, you have swell. You don't need that, right? Here in Switzerland, where I live, I'm happy to go pump foiling because there's nothing else to do most of the time. So,
yeah, exactly.
I've gone through your YouTube. I don't know if I've seen every video of you because they're quite a bunch, but I've never seen your workspace. I've never seen a 3D printer. Is that all secret, or do you give sneak peeks sometimes to people?
Anybody who comes to the house can see it. If you want to tour, hold on. See if the connection holds.
That would be awesome.
Hold on. Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Hold on. It's a bit dark, but if I turn this around, the 3D printers live here.
No, you cannot see anything.
Can you actually see anything?
But if you want to see it, you can go to the YouTube and look at his shed.
There's the big bed one, and I use the smaller one for smaller parts like adapters and so on. And I have to see if the Wi-Fi signal will hold if I go into the bigger workshop. The youths don't disconnect. and it's where I do most of the shaping and stuff. Am I still connected? You can see this?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, 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 oh. Connected?
No, not anymore. I guess.
Okay, that went too far. Hold on. But I have a way, I think. Hold on. Because I have a window into this thing. You can see this. All right, so this is the workshop. If you guys can see that now, so I'm still connected.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
Up there is a bunch of molds for like the newer foils that I'm making up on that shelf. A lot of stabilizers and a couple of front wings there. And that's essentially it. That is the magic. I've got all my carbon in the cold room in the back, and that's it.
Do you keep the old molds? Or do you you have a foil that goes into serial production and then you give the molds to the office, or what do you do with them?
They're mostly trashed after like two or three foils that come out of them, because they're essentially plastic. They're done.
Okay.
So
he's asking because he wants to produce foils himself.
You know what? Actually, yeah. I just bought some carbon fiber and I wanted to do at least a stab. So I 3D printed one. You can actually see it in the back, the small one here, but it hums. What? So I thought I'd buy some filament. I don't know how you call it. The thing that goes into the 3D printer that has carbon fiber in it. I'm going to try to print the small one. And if that doesn't work, I'll try to 3D work. Print a mold and do that. That doesn't work?
Try that. No. Maybe it'll you go 10, 15 meters and then it will actually snap. The carbon fiber reinforced PLA.
Oh, snap
PLA.
Even.
Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't work. Because this one is like maybe 20 centimeters, pretty small. And it bends a lot.
You can see it's flexing.
Like the other one will snap, you say.
You'd be surprised how much force is still on the stabilizer. It's like if you want to test your force, put it on your fuselage, put it up on two blocks, and then stand on it. That's essentially the force that's going to be put out on that thing when you're riding. So it's eventually going
to...
It's holding up pretty good. Yeah.
Okay.
But the thing is, that's flexible.
That's PLA.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you print it out of carbon reinforced PLA, it'll be stiff. So with stiffness comes like brittleness. So at a certain point, it'll just snap off, and then it's a long swim back. Especially if it happens to your front wing.
Yeah.
Now, if your stabilizer goes, I got good when I was trying to 3D print like the stabilizers in the beginning. I got quite good at riding back to the beach with half a stabilizer.
Yeah. that is super interesting. But yeah, as I said, now you're full professional, and the molds, you don't need them anymore. Is there anything like now you have the Barracuda that came out, but I can imagine you're already on the next project.
Yeah.
Anything always. You can talk about?
Not really. No, I mean, essentially people can guess, but I mean, the Barracuda was an aspect ratio 10 wing that, you know, that was basically finished the sizes end of last year. So obviously working on higher aspect things. I like to stay on the performance and glidey side. You know, Andy and Jan, the other designers, are more for like the wider user market. So the medium aspect foils, the pump foils, and so on. I am just more about going fast and gliding. I'm really into downwinding now. And also with the para wings and so on, the sort of easy downwinding. So I like making foils for that. So pretty much that's what I'm working on. And new boards.
What foil would you recommend to downwind? Because I was downwinding the day before yesterday. It was like 0 to 2 degrees. It was way too much wind, like 25 to 35 knots. I had your big board. And I had the Condor M, because that's the only foil I have.
Yeah, it's too big.
I used the Roger Parawing, which was way too big as well. Any foil you would recommend for that?
In that wind, you want something fast. Like I think you sent me the video of those conditions, and I would be on like a Barracuda S, like a race foil. If I'm that powered up, if I like I said, if I had that wing and I was so lit up, and on a big board, I would have definitely taken like 600 or smaller square centimeter foil, because it would be fun. It'd allow you to turn on those waves rather than just going straight. Condor or any pump foil has a problem. As they go fast, they will pitch down. That's just the way the pump profiles work. So they're not lent to being very good downwind foils, especially in good downwind conditions. Like really crappy light wind where there's like a foot of swell. Great. They work great for that. They never get past the 10, 12 knot speed where you have like a pitching moment. But if you have good downwind conditions like here, there's no wave that's going to be under 15 knots. It's always going to be over that speed threshold. So you need foils that work. And then obviously you want something that glides so you don't have to re-engage your parawing or start paddling again. So you want something that's high aspect that has a broad speed range, which allow you to slow down to make turns, but still has enough speed if you need to overtake a couple of waves to stay on your main swell, that you have that option too. Now, for example, pump foils do not allow that. Pump foils stick at one speed. They reach that like 9 to 10 knot wall.
Yeah,
and that's it. That there's no acceleration after that, and all the waves are faster, and you get stuck, and then you get bogged down. It's just not fun.
That's super interesting. Maybe we can, now you talked a lot about your work and whatnot. Maybe we can ask some question about your personal life, because you've been a racer. You did a lot of freestyle tricks, and in one podcast, you said that you get a little older, and these 3-4 spins that the youngsters do, you're not up for that, not anymore, maybe. Are you still racing? I heard that you want to do the Defi Wing. Did you do it?
No. I was going to do it last year. But talking about personal life, I got divorced last year. So,
sorry to hear.
That sort of screwed up all my plans. It was not a good time in my life, and I pretty much lost all motivation to do any competitions or anything like that. So my plan of doing Defi Wing just went straight out the window. I was fully prepared. I had like a 300 square centimeter Mike's Lab foil and everything. I was ready to like just go kick ass.
Insane.
Because I've always been one of the fastest in all the racing fleets in a straight line. So for me, I was like, all right, I've always missed Defi Wing because it's always been another competition that I had to go to. 2024, I'm going to go kick ass. And then it was like, oh, well, that's not. So
you stopped competing.
I mean, my first race last year was like in June, where my mom just pulled me. It was like, get your butt to Switzerland and like, you know, stop moping around and do something. So yeah, I did that one race last year.
So that was probably also the post that I've seen where you said that you were in Silla Plana, you had a hard year. So that was probably due to that. The worst then, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Sorry to hear.
Yeah, it happens.
Can imagine. I have a question about the old products, because I can imagine your garage is full of foils, not just your test foils, but I guess you also get them once they're mass produced to maybe compare to your tests if it's on the same level. Do you all keep those, or do you have to hand them back? Do you have to throw them away maybe so people don't get your special original foils? What happens to those things, and how full is your garage?
The garage is extremely full. It's not just my garage. If you look back at that video I just showed you of the workshop, that workshop goes all the way to the back, and then there's a storage thing on top of that where I keep all like essentially the museum pieces. And my garden is full of museum boards. So it's like kite boards from like the early 2000s, and probably all my first designs for foil boards for kite foiling and wing foiling are back out there. The ones that survived, there's a lot of stuff that got broken or, you know, lost or things like that, which I regret not having. But yeah, but nowadays, like old prototypes never survive. Like we have to do essentially breakage tests. We have to figure out where these things will break and so on and so on. So it's very rare to have an old prototype that is still in one piece, especially here.
Yeah, but I guess that you like don't sell where you live because you're living in the every foiler's dream, probably.
Yeah, it's good.
You said, Gunnar, before that when you go in the water, it's not fun, it's work. So, but you still enjoy going on the water or not at all? And you feel like maybe you're going to change career somehow? Because, I mean, I don't hate my job, of course, I don't love it all the time. But how's your journey going? What's next with Gunnar?
I'm slowly recovering from last year. I mean, if you would have asked me the question last year, you know, do you still go out to have fun on the water? It was no. I was trying, but like nothing was fun. Winging wasn't fun. Kiting wasn't fun. Surf foiling wasn't fun. Surfing is definitely not fun on this island anyway. And what got me through last year, if you sort of see that in the background, is archery. That's a sport that I do with my daughter now. So it helped me connect with my daughter a lot more. And it's a very different sport. It's also very meditative. So you can shut off all the stuff that's happening on the outside when you're doing that sport. It's been quite helpful. But recently, let's say in the last couple of months, I've been really getting back into especially kite foiling and like especially with having also new product help when you're like testing, you sort of see like there's some like positive results coming out of it. So it motivates you to go on the water more. So as I've also gotten more happy with the new situation and so on, I've been a lot more happy on the water again too. So I'm not going to be stopping water sports anytime soon, and I'm probably going to be more in the water more and more often nowadays.
That's awesome. Great to hear. You're going to be at the boat next week. Well, if we air that, the boat will already have passed. We unfortunately cannot meet because I'm only there the first weekend. It will come up afterwards. But I have a question because I read somewhere, not sure if that's correct or not. It not only says Spanish Wingfoil Race Champion, it says also musician.
Yeah.
Please elaborate.
I play most instruments. I have perfect pitch. I mean, I play guitar, bass, drums, almost anything that makes a sound I can sort of play. Nowadays, I mainly play drums to the delight of all my neighbors. I started like a small personal YouTube project. If people want to look for it, type in my name and type in music. You'll find my horrible cover attempts at drumming and so on.
If you put the effort into music that you put into foils, I guess it's not going to be that as bad as you say it is.
Yeah, I don't put that much
effort into music. That is super cool. But so a question I ask all my guests is if you can choose the weather, the waves, the situation of water, what gear would you choose? What sport would you choose? Would you go kite foiling? Would you go winging? Would you go prone surfing? What would you do and why?
Good question. It really depends on the condition. I have this essential mantra saying that there are no bad conditions. Now, there's no bad conditions. There's only the wrong material. So let's start right at the low end. If there's no wind whatsoever and there's no waves, yeah, I will figure out either a way of dock starting or I'll do flat water paddle ups. That's great for the cardio. It's fun. Something like that. I've built myself like my own little dock start ladder thing. It's very rudimentary, but it allows me to dock start a lot more than I used to. And in the winter, there's not so many restrictions on the beaches. In the summer, the lifeguards will kick you off immediately, but in the winter, I can dock start. So, but in the summer, we have wind anyway, so it's not a big issue. And then we get to light wind. If the wind is anything between like 5 knots to 10 knots, I much prefer the kite foil. 13 meter foil kite, Barracuda S, love it. You can boost high, you're speeding along, you're typically alone on the water. It's like great to do that. And then anything sort of 15 knots plus, winging. If it's flat, great, go racing. If it's wavy, go wave riding. If it's really big waves, yeah, just go enjoy. And if it's very like cool, stupidly windy,
no
then,
windsurfing.
Then it gets,
I heard.
Yeah, windsurfing, I'm too old for that. Windsurfing takes too much energy to have fun in windsurfing. The conditions need to be really perfect, and they in Fuerteventura, at least, they rarely are. We're not like on Gran Canaria where you have super windy conditions all the time. Like, it's not like living in Poso where like the only sail I need is a 3.7. Here the typical sail size is like a 5 at most, like the smallest, and typically 5.3, 5.7, and it's not fun, and it takes too long to rig up, and it's massive. Everything is with that sport is just with having winging as an alternative. It's like, I don't need this sport. And like I said, it takes you half an hour to catch a wave here with waves. Yeah. And then you get into a lot of arguments with wingers and kiters. So it's not a sport that I have. My windsurfing gear is in my shed and it's rusting and getting sandy and salty, but I haven't touched it in years. I think I actually just lent my boom to like one of my
friends.
And
we see that more and more with every guest that we get here. Why did you say that waves are not that great there in Fuerte? And is there a better island for wave riding in the Canary?
What I mean with that is for windsurf wave riding. So if you're windsurfing, right, Tenerife and Gran Canaria are far better, at least on a consistent thing. There you have good conditions every day, like in the summer. In the summer, Fuerteventura is mostly flat. Like, we don't get swell. And the wind swell doesn't quite push up in like a large wave like it does in Gran Canaria, like in Poso. So windsurfing is extremely boring unless you do freestyle on Fuerteventura, because it's all flat water conditions. Winging is a little bit more fun because the wind swell that's being pushed through, you get these nice rollers and so on. They can get quite big. So for wings and foils, they work fine. But for windsurfing, it's not great. In the winter, we can get epic, really epic windsurfing conditions, but there are, let's say, once a month. It can be amazing, but it's you wait a long time. And as you get older, waiting a long time means you get unfit. And then by the time you go out, all your material breaks and then you break. it's good to have like sports like wing foiling, which keep you on the water and still allow you to sail at a high level.
Yeah, it's actually pretty much the same here, I would say. No really big waves in summertime. And how about like prone foiling? Because we know that you're onto that as well and downwinding. So how about the conditions for those things?
Love it. We have actually really good conditions here. In the winter, if there would be no wind, you could go surf foiling every day. We have a couple of spots which are amazing for surf and sup foiling. Like, I don't need to hide Flag Beach. Flag Beach at low tide with an easterly, northeasterly swell is bloody amazing for all levels of surf and sup foiling. Yeah, you have a nice long wave that doesn't break on rocks or anything. Yeah, it's paradise. If you want to learn to surf well, that's the beach you want to go to. It's gotten full with, like, I think 10 people. We have other, let's say, more popular spots, which if I would tell you what they're called or where they are, then the locals would be extremely annoyed with me for doing that, even though I'm probably the first guy who went there. But I can understand it there. It's a bit secret spot on the North Shore and so on. It's gotten very full, but it's still not as full as surfing. Surfing, I love surfing, but it's impossible to do. I mean, I used to drop my daughter at school and then go like for a surf at Rocky Point or something like that. Now, even at like 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, it's like there's 100 people in the water. Like there's, like, you know, you're not going to catch a wave. So it's just like, I'd like to do it, but I'd much rather just take my surf foil gear, go like two beaches down and catch 50 waves. Yeah. Go home happy rather even than there's fighting more, with so many people. And sometimes you get really long. You have a longer ride with foils. You have much longer ride. Like at Flag Beach, if you can catch the wave on the left, that's a 2-3 minute ride.
Yeah, I saw that video. It looked amazing. Really cool. So listen, I'm actually through with my list. If anything else you want to add, Gunnar?
I exhausted all my questions and I think it was a great episode. But if Gunnar, you have anything to add, maybe you do.
Not much. Just to say the future looks actually quite bright.
All right.
Things have slowed down a little bit on the wing foiling side, but now with para-winging coming in, I think also talking with a lot of like the other, let's say, sailing brands, I mean, they're going to see a lot of new para-wings coming out. We're just at the beginning now, like the para-wings you see on the water now, that's very rudimentary. As coming from a kite design standpoint, there's so much more we can do and so much cooler things we can do. It's going to be...
You're right.
I think it's going to be... So, it has a potential to actually be an almost bigger sport than winging. So we definitely need to keep an eye on this as a sport.
Why do you think it's going to be bigger than winging? Because you can pack it easier, don't need to bring two backpacks and a pump.
That's one thing. It's less fragile from a material standpoint. Again, if you're purely into wave riding, the purest thing you can do, I love surf foiling because there's nothing in your hand. You know, it's like stand-up paddling is sort of the next thing along. But like, for example, going on downwinders paddling, you need to have a very high level. And at a certain age, sometimes you don't have the energy to do it. Whereas with para-winging allows you to do it just on a downwinding side. But also, you can go into large swell where you'd normally just tow into with this wing. Even if you get washed, it's not a problem. You still have the wing with you. And it's going to allow people to get into it. It's going to be a fairly easy sport to learn. It's fairly safe. And you just have to look at the cost. And I'm hoping that para-winging is not going to go quite the way that winging went on the cost side. Winging has gotten extremely expensive, and I don't quite agree with the pricing at the moment on all the wings. Especially, again, getting back to like the wings I ride made out of monofilm, they are very cheap compared to something made out of Velula, which, however, is in the same weight class. Like the aqueous wings are maybe 100, 200 grams heavier than like an Alula wing, but costs, you know, 1,400, I think, for a 6 meter compared to like 3 grand. So it's, yeah. So at the moment, a para wing, which is like $900, it's still expensive for what it is. And I think with more and more brands getting into it, the price will actually come down in the beginning. Just knowing how much something like that is to manufacture, it's quite interesting to see that it's almost 1,000. But there's a lot of potential there, just a lot alone on price.
All right. I still have to get back and use it in a little better suited conditions because it was a little too much. Maybe just before we end and announce the next guest, we'll do that. We'll do that. I used the big board as well, but I think that was no problem. That wasn't the issue, really. Maybe you can just, as a maybe public announcement. You can just tell me what you said before again, because I introduced you as Gunnar. You said that people call you differently. How do you introduce yourself if you don't know what language the other one speaks?
I just typically introduce myself as Gunnar, or essentially as Chinatown, because I've been known as that for so long.
All right, then we'll do that the way you said. Next episode is going to be with Sam Goddens. He's making sustainable foils at Onyx Foils. You've probably heard of him. He also organizes huge events, and I'm really looking forward to talking to him. I'm pretty excited. I have never heard of that brand before, and I'm looking forward to hear his vision and what he has to tell us.
Awesome.
Great time.
So thank you very much, Gunnar, for being here. And thank you very much, everybody, for listening. See you in the next one.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Thanks for the interview.